And welcome once again to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and on the web at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Writers on Writing features authors, editors, poets, and literary agents discussing the art and the business of writing. And today my guest is T. Karagason Boyle. T.C. Boyle was born in 1948 in Peekskill, New York. He was accepted into the Iowa Writers' Workshop in 1972 and received his doctorate in 19th century English literature from the University of Iowa in 1977. Also in 1977, T.C. accepted a teaching position at the University of Southern California, where he still teaches. He's the author of 9 previous novels, including Budding Prospects, World's End, The Tortilla Curtain, Riven Rock, and Drop City. His short story collections include Descent of Man, Greasy Lake, If the River Was Whiskey, Without a Hero, T.C. Boyle's Stories, and After the Plague. His new short story collection, Tooth and Claw, will be published by Viking in September of 2005. He was the recipient of the 1999 Penn Malamud Award for Excellence in Short Fiction, and he is here today to talk about his new novel, The Inner Circle, published by Viking. And before we bring him on, let me also say that the views and opinions you hear on this show are those of me and my guest and not those of the University of California, Irvine Regents. Hi, T.C.
Hi, Barbara. Before we even get into it, that is one great song you have leading in. It expresses exactly how I feel about writing. Nothing but heartbreak and sorrow and misery.
And yet your bio is just sopping with success here.
What? No, I'm only kidding. Sometimes can be frustrating, as all the writers of the world know, and that includes everybody listening who has bad recollections of having written those term papers in high school and college. But when it goes well, it can be quite a great joy.
It sounds like it has pretty much gone well for you since college, no?
Well, I've had my ups and downs, like everyone, but I've been lucky in being productive and having found an audience for my work, and it just keeps sustaining me.
Did you worry about that early on? Did you back then? Did you have any inkling of, marketplace and marketing and all of that I don't think was in the consciousness of writers the way it is now. Was
not in the least, Barbara. In fact, I was young then. Now I'm extremely elderly. And then I worried about nothing except what to destroy next. Now I worry about everything. Everything that happens to humanity throughout the planet and all the dying species and everything else. I mean, that's just the nature of becoming old. On the other hand, marketing was something that I never really gave a thought to because I just felt that I was going to do something great and the world would come to me and appreciate it.
And it has.
Yeah, but an awful lot of marketing went into it in between, and that is the part, that's what the publisher does for you.
Sure.
I will tell you a story along these lines. I had published 4 books with Viking. All my books have been with them and all have always been in print, which is wonderful, but I was coming out with the book that they called my breakout book in 1987, World's End.
Mm-hmm.
Prior to this, I'd never been on any book tours, and I'd never even known that we had a marketing director. Now, suddenly, they decided to bless me. And from then on, of course, my life has been one continuous, eternal, endless book tour.
Huh. You do it well, though.
I do enjoy being on stage, and I do enjoy performing for the audience and getting their feedback. I really love it. I'm a ham at heart. On the other hand, the travel, the perpetual travel is wearing me down, and it does take me away from my work and, more importantly, my wife. You know, there's no one to clean up after her when I'm not here.
Oh, dear. Well, let's talk a little bit about the Inner Circle and how this book came about.
Well, The Inner Circle, as I think many listeners will know, is a novel set around the sex researches of Alfred C. Kinsey, he of the Kinsey Reports, in Bloomington, Indiana, during the period from approximately 1939 through his death in 1956. I knew the name of Kinsey, as most people do. It floated in the ether, but of course, Kinsey wasn't really a ready subject in anybody's mind in these days. But I had read David Halberstam's The 50s. It's a wonderful little pop history of that era, and there were bios of some of the figures of the era, and one was of Kinsey. And I filed that away because what he did in trying to separate the animal part of us from our spiritual or emotional part really appealed to me. I've written about such things a lot. He was a Darwinist, as I am. And I am always trying to discover what we're doing on this planet and what it's all about and how we do have a spiritual essence as well as an animal side and where the two collide or never meet.
Interesting. So how much research did you have to actually do? Because it sounds like you did a ton. I feel like I'm learning so much about Kinsey that I had no idea about. And it feels authentic and feels that you researched this guy.
Well, thank you. As with my previous Dr. Kellogg of my 93 novel, The Road to Wellville, the guy who invented the cornflake and had the Battle Creek Sanitarium and came up with all these bizarre treatments for people, all that stuff is true to fact. All the bizarre sexual things in this book are true to the historical fact. That's the fun of doing such a novel. I'm presenting to you some oddities of history that reflect on who we are now and are important to us now, but we might not have been aware of them until I bring them to the fore. There are 4 extant biographies on Kinsey, the 2 sensational ones by James Jones and Jonathan Gaythorne Hardy, which came out in the 90s and revealed that behind his mask of being a disinterested scientist, Kinsey was a real sexual enthusiast and participated in what many people might find very kinky activities. The previous 2 biographies by Cornelia Christensen and Wardell Pomeroy, who worked with him, don't reveal much of that, but they do reveal a great deal of who Kinsey himself was and what he was like. So there was a starting point. I then subsequently went to the Kinsey Institute at Bloomington, Indiana, at the university there, and people were very, very helpful to me. I did research there, came home, and as I've done before, found an opening line and at an image and a character and let it fly.
So it began with an opening line.
Yes.
Is the opening line in the book, I think it's, I have it right here, was it the opening line of the prologue or was it the opening line?
Yes, of course. I always build my books and stories like a house, brick by brick, a brick wall, let's say a brick wall, a brick by brick. It goes day to day and I don't know where it will go or what it will be. All that is part of the process of discovery involved in writing fiction.
Do you have the ending?
No, I have nothing. Nothing whatsoever.
Interesting.
I have material, and I don't know why I'm researching it. I don't go into a book like this thinking, well, that Kinsey, he was overrated, and he was a pervert, and I'm going to nail him to the wall. Yeah. No, I don't have any political purpose. I think, you know, I would be better served to write a biography or an essay if that were the case. Something fascinates me, and I want to find out why. And so I begin to see it and imagine it and let it evolve. The structure comes innately, organically, as the book grows day by day by day, or even a short story. It's the same as true. I may have ideas as I move along as to what will happen next, where it will go, how it will resolve itself, but sometimes these ideas are simply ideas and don't come to fruition. You don't know what it will be until you actually do it. I think that is why fiction is so fascinating to me, and I think to many readers, too. It's not predictable, at least non-genre fiction. You're on a journey somewhere with the author, and the author doesn't know where he's going either. But this is not to say that, you know, I'm just throwing something together. I work intensely on this and let my unconscious resolve some of the problems of theme and characterization and the evolution of the plot day by day by day. It takes a book like this takes many months, sometimes years to write.
Interesting. If you just tuned in, you are listening to Writers on Writing, and I'm here today with T.C. Boyle, author of The Inner Circle, published by Viking. So you said you let your unconscious resolve problems or take you onward. Is that process even conscious? I mean, will you go to sleep thinking, okay, I don't know what you know, Kinsey and John Milk are supposed to do in this room, but in the morning I'll know.
Not exactly. When I'm done with work each day at 2 or 3 in the afternoon, whenever it is, things seem to go dead and I realize that's it for the day. I would read aloud to my wife to hear how it goes, to hear the rhythm of it and see what it is. And that sometimes will give me the opportunity to leap ahead and have some ideas of where it's going and why I'm doing it. And I'll put it right out of my mind for the rest of the day and go do something that has nothing to do with writing, like digging holes in the yard and filling them right back up again, which I'm really good at. And when I go to sleep, maybe I will think of the character, just of the name of the character maybe, but I don't know if I'm doing any fruitful dreaming about it. It's not till the next day when I sit down and revise what I've done previously and go over it and over it that I am able sometimes to leap ahead.
Hmm. So the protagonist, the main character, John Milk, who is Kinsey's assistant, first intern and then paid assistant. How did you decide on him as your narrator?
Well, this is a very different point of view book from, let's say, the one we talked about last when I was on your show, Drop City.
Yes.
Which has 5 points of view, and you get to get inside characters' minds and see what each character is thinking about a given situation. And that is wonderful because the author can stand back and use any sort of language that he likes. The characters can evolve in opposition to one another. This is very different. I hit upon the idea of doing this as an I narrative, as a kind of apologia pro vita sua by John Milk. The prologue is being tape recorded. He's sitting down before a tape recorder as Kinsey, his guru and idol and boss, has died, and he goes then back to the beginning and tells how he met him and how he became a sexologist and so on. This was fun for me to do an iNarrative. I hadn't done one at this length since my second novel, Budding Prospects, all the way back in 1984. And it also, I think, enables the reader to get a little bit of ironic distance on this character. He is perhaps not entirely reliable, and he's not also entirely aware of what he's getting into. Each reader will see for him or herself where perhaps he's stepping over the bounds or fooling himself or rationalizing. And particularly this has to do with his relationship with Kinsey, with Kinsey's wife, with some of the subjects of the sex research, and with his own wife, Iris.
So how, then, do you decide on structure? I mean, again, you said Drop City was a multiple point of view novel, and The Inner Circle very much is told from John Milk's point of view. How does that come to you? Is it more a sense of you really need these different points of views to tell the story, therefore it's a multiple point of view novel, or one is enough, as in the case of The Inner Circle?
Oh, shucks, Barbara. I'm just doing what comes natural. I've written a lot of short stories, probably 150 of them now. I don't know. I haven't counted. And some are in third person, some are in first person. And it just seems right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just something that happens. And the structure, as we said earlier, evolves from that, scene by scene. It's built, you know, a short story is built in scenes. A chapter is built in scenes, and then the chapters build toward a novel. I don't think it's something that can be analyzed. There's a kind of a freedom in creating art, a kind of play that occurs that involves certainly conscious control and the assimilative process of all the reading you've done and the writing you've done in the past and all your experience and all of that. But you're largely in another place, controlled by the unconscious mind, when you are working. Everyone has this experience. We have it also on the other end when we're reading a book, when we're just taken out of the world. That's what it's about. That's why we do it.
Yes.
So it's really difficult to analyze how a work gets made. Everyone is interested in what a given artist's methods are, of course, because they wonder how to do it for themselves. But each person has to find his or her own way of doing it, and I'm sure there are authors who are quite different from me. An author I admire very much, Kazuo Shiguro, who wrote The Remains of the Day, mm-hmm. has said, I've never met him, he said in interviews that he just walks around for 2 years thinking, you know? Mm-hmm. And when he's done thinking, he knows everything in his novel, and he sits down and he writes it. If I were to work in that way, we wouldn't be having this conversation because I'd be wrapped in chains in the sub-basement of the Camarillo Mental Hospital. So we all have to find our own way to get into the work. A final word on this. I was coming back from London last year on the Eternal Tour for Drop City, and they were flying me business class, very nice, in some fancy airplane with little pop-up TVs. Now, this flight is forever. I mean, it's like 12 hours. You almost hope the plane will crash because it's so horrible to be up there. And so, you know, you want to you read books, of course, but, you know, you want to watch a movie, too. Well, all the seats were taken, and my little movie thing didn't work. But I had a book in reserve, a kind of, you know, candy kind of chewing on a book just for fun, and it was the biography of the musician Neil Young called Shaky.
Mm.
And here is, in essence, what you learn from Shaky. People come up to Neil Young, and they say, Neil, man, you transformed my life. You wrote Cinnamon Girl, man. How did you do that? And Neil says, oh, it just came to me, and I pulled the pickup truck over on the way to the store, wrote it in 3 minutes, you know? I mean, essentially, that's what we're talking about. It just happens.
Oh, well, that's encouraging, actually. But will you read to us?
Oh, sure, of course. Since we'll do two readings, I'll save the kinkier one for last. How's
okay,
that?
That's great.
How long would you like me to read, Barbara?
Oh, 3-4 minutes, at least.
Okay. Well, since we've already talked about opening lines and how it opens with the prologue, why don't we begin with that?
Sure.
And perhaps also to set it up, I might read the two epigraphs. Kinsey had said, quite famously, that the poets have had 2,000 years to write about love. Now I, a scientist, as I said, will tell you simply about the physiology of sex. So I've chosen two quotes to illustrate that divide. The first is from William Shakespeare's Antony and Cleopatra. Eternity was in our lips and eyes, bliss in our brows bent. The second is from Kinsey himself, Sexual Behavior in the Human Female, the second of the two volumes of the Kinsey Reports. Some sort of non-penile stimulation of the female genitalia is almost universal among the lower mammals, where, however, the lack of prehensile hands places the burden of activity on the nose and mouth of the male. So you can see, there's quite a contrast there. This is from the prologue, Bloomington, Indiana, August 25th, 1956. And I should say that Kinsey's nickname is PROK, P-R-O-K, standing for Professor K. Looking back on it now, I don't think I was ever actually sex-shy, to use one of Prok's pet phrases. But I'll admit I was pretty naive when I first came to him, not to mention hopelessly dull and conventional. I don't know what he saw in me, really. Or perhaps I do. If you'll forgive me a moment of vanity, my wife, Iris, claims I was something of a heartthrob on campus, though I would have been the last to know of it because I wasn't dating and had always been uncomfortable with the sort of small talk that leads up to the casual inquiry about after-class plans or what you might or might not be doing on Saturday after the game. I had a pretty fair physique in those days, with a matching set of full-back shoulders and a 30-inch waist. And unlike most men at college, I was conscientious about keeping myself in trim. I still am. But that's neither here nor there. To complete the portrait, because already I've managed to get myself out on a limb here, I was blessed with what Iris calls sensitive eyes, whatever that might mean, and a thatch of wheat-colored hair with a natural curl that defeated any cream or pomade I'd ever come across. As for sex, I was eager but inexperienced and shy in the usual way, unsure of myself and just about as uninformed as anyone you could imagine. In fact, the first time I developed anything more than a theoretical grasp of what coitus involved, the mechanics of the act, that is, was during my senior year at IU in the fall of 1939, when I found myself sitting in a lecture hall jammed to the rafters with silent, dry-mouthed students of both sexes as Prok's color slides played hugely across the screen. I was there at the instigation of a girl named Laura Feeney, one of the campus femme fatale, who never seemed to go anywhere without an arm looped through some letterman's. Laura had the reputation of being fast, although I can assure you I was never the beneficiary of her sexual largesse, if in fact the rumors were true. As I was later to learn, the most provocative-looking women often have the most repressed sex lives, and vice versa. I remember being distinctly flattered when she stopped me in the corridor one day during fall registration, took hold of my arm at the muscle, and pecked a kiss to my cheek. "Oh, hi, John," she breathed. "I was just thinking about you. How was your summer?" My summer had been spent back home in Michigan City, stocking shelves and bagging groceries, and if I had 5 minutes to myself, my mother had me pruning the trees, reshingling the roof, and pulling weeds in the vegetable garden. I was lonely, bored to tears, masturbating twice a day in my attic room that was like a sweatbox in a penal institution. My only relief derived from books. I came under the spell of John Donne and Andrew Marvell that summer, and I reread Sir Philip Sidney's Astrophel and Stella 3 times in preparation for an English literature course I was looking forward to in the fall. But I couldn't tell Laura Feeney all of this, or any of it. She would have thought me a washout, which I was. So I just shrugged and said, "All right, I guess." Voices reverberated in the stairwell, boomed in the corners, and fled all the way down the corridor to where the registration tables had been set up in the gymnasium. "Yeah," Laura said, and her smile went cold a moment. "I know how you feel. With me, it was work, work, work. My father owns a lunch counter in Fort Wayne. Did you know that?" I didn't know. I shook my head and felt a whole shining loop of my hair fall loose, though I must have used half a bottle of cream oil on it. I was wearing one of the stiff new Arrow shirts my grandmother had sent me from Chicago, and a Glen plaid tie I think I wore to class every day that year in the hope of making a good impression. My briefcase was in one hand, a stack of library books in the other. As I've said, the gift of small talk eluded me. I think I said something like, "Fort Wayne, huh?" In any event, it didn't matter what I said, because she let her turquoise eyes go wide, gave my muscle a squeeze, and lowered her voice. "Listen," she said, "I just wanted to know if you'd mind getting engaged to me." Her words hung there between us, closing out everything else, the chatter of the group of freshmen materializing suddenly from the men's room, the sound of an automobile horn out on the street, and I can only imagine the look I must have given her in response. This was long before Proc taught me to tuck all the loose strands of my emotions behind a mask of impassivity, and everything I was thinking routinely rushed to my face, along with the blood that settled in my cheeks like a barometer of confusion. "John, you're not blushing, are you?" "No," I said, "not at all. I'm just..." She held my eyes, enjoying the moment. "Just what?" I shrugged. "Oh, we were out in the sun. Yesterday it was. Yesterday afternoon, moving furniture, so I guess, well..." Someone brushed by me, an undergraduate who looked vaguely familiar. Had he been in my psych class last year? And then she let the other shoe drop. "I mean, just for the semester, for pretend." She looked away, and her hair rose and fell in an ebbing wave. When she turned back to me, she lifted her face till it was like a satellite of my own, pale and glowing in the infusion of light from the windows at the end of the corridor. "You know," she said, "for the marriage course."
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
That was T.C. Boyle reading from The Inner Circle. And we're going to take a very quick break. And when we come back, he will still be with us. So don't go anywhere. Keep your eyes on the road and stay tuned. Be right back.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Be gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Darling, one month built in a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI-FM. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and on the web at KUCI.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I am here with T.C. Boyle, author of The Inner Circle, published by Viking. Hi there.
Hi, Barbara.
Curious about John Milk's name. Will you talk about coming up with this name? I keep thinking there's some sort of symbolic value to his last name, Milk.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes, I think you're quite right in assuming that. Sometimes characters' names do strike the author and with symbolic value, although you don't want to play this up too much, of course, because it has to be within the realm of possibility. And sometimes characters are just simply named, and names come to the author and in the way that they just pop into your head. In the case of John Milk, yes, his name just came to me. However, it does have a great deal of symbolic value in this book, and we also get an explanation of his name, which was from German, from his background, and his grandfather had changed it from Milch, the original German, to Milk. And I think readers can make of that what they will as they begin to discover his character and whether or not this name says something about him.
Interesting. Yeah, well, it does.
Well, you see, that's not for me to say. I don't think it's right for the author to interpret the book. I think the reader deserves the opportunity and right to interpret it in his or her own way.
Was that his name to begin with?
Yes.
From the start?
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. What are the legalities of writing a novel like this, basing a novel on a real-life character who's no longer with us?
Well, the American legal system is quite clear on this. You cannot defame anyone who is dead. Both Kinsey and his wife, who appear as characters in this book, although not the main characters, are both dead. I would feel uncomfortable, however, putting words in the mouths of people who are still alive. There were three members of the inner circle, three men, similar in some respects to the three men that I've created, although this is not a Romana Clay in any sense. And as of the writing of this book, as far as I understand, two of them are still alive. Further, Kinsey's children, I believe, are still alive. So I wouldn't want to have them acting and saying things that they might not have said in real life, whether there's a legal question involved or not. I'm a novelist, and I'm not interested in writing a kind of bio novel. I'm interested in creating a scenario and dramatizing what it might be like to be a sexologist and to work for a man as overpowering as Kinsey was. So as far as the characters whom I have parading around and doing and saying things, Kinsey and his wife, they are historical figures. They are no longer with us. So I see no problem in representing them in fiction, as I've represented Dr. Kellogg and Stanley McCormick and Rivenrock and others. If you come to think of it, it's a good thing, because you couldn't write a novel about Abraham Lincoln if that weren't the case, because I'm sure he has successors who would want to sue you and so on. So if a person has passed into history, you can't be slandering them.
Yeah. So you can take the biographical material that's out there and use it and write your novel, and not, if you find it in biography and research, assume that, for instance, see, I have never read a biography on Kinsey, mm-hmm. So I didn't know he was bisexual.
Yeah, well, there are four biographies.
Yeah.
So they're telling some of the same stories.
Sure.
Some of the same material. And plus, you know, the Kinsey Institute has a great deal of material available for scholars to do their original research, mm-hmm. and find out whether this is true or not. Yes, Kinsey, the books we were talking about in the first half of the show, the two biographies that came out in the 90s, revealed all of this, what went on behind closed doors.
Mm-hmm.
Kinsey presented himself to the American public as a disinterested scientist who was going to tell us about the physiology of sex, period. He was very straight-laced, very proper. He was a professor of zoology, distinguished, the foremost expert in the world on the gall wasp. he was married. He had three children. He insisted that the three men who worked with him be married and have children so that there was an appearance of normalcy here, so that no one could say that he is sensationalizing sex. He is simply recording data. That was his job. But on the other hand, he couldn't help, because he couldn't help revealing how progressive his attitudes were and what an iconoclast he was in terms of expressing sex in society. He felt that all things go between consenting adults, and that people's lives had been ruined because of repressive mores, sex laws, mores, and conventions. And behind the scenes, as these biographies revealed, yes, he was fully bisexual. In fact, on his own scale of 0 to 6, 0 being fully heterosexual and 6 being fully homosexual, he would have rated himself perhaps a 4.5 toward the end of his life.
Hmm.
And so, yes, all of these revelations came out of the biographies.
Interesting. That is fascinating. So how do you get into the psyche, then, of a fictional Kinsey assistant?
Well, John Milk came to him as a student.
Yes.
He was a student in the sex class. The section that we read before the break goes on from there to have John Milk and this girl who asked him to be engaged to her, just for pretend, go into the course and see the slides of coitus up on the wall and have Kinsey talk very frankly about sex and so on. He then has to go to Kinsey to give his sex history. Kinsey demanded of everyone in his audience that they would give their case history of their sex lives. Typically, this would involve 250 to 350 questions, a face-to-face interview in a soundproof room, total anonymity guaranteed, and Kinsey would simply collect data. He didn't care whether you never had sex or you had sex every minute of the day with everything that moved. He was simply recording data about the human animal. At any rate, when Kinsey would give a lecture, he would invite everyone, he would pursue everyone to come to him privately to give up their case histories. And in my fictional account, that is how John Milk becomes acquainted with his with Kinsey. Kinsey brings him in, gets his sex history, and amusingly and truly, measurements were required. And these Kinsey would give each of his correspondents a little 3x5 postcard with a stamped and addressed. And in the case of men, at any rate, they were required to measure themselves, both flaccid and hard, and send this data in to Dr. Kinsey. So we get some amusing scenes along those lines. And in my telling, Kinsey is attracted to him, and he becomes the first worker for Kinsey, but he's very naive and just fumbling around. He's only 21 years old.
Mm. Yeah, it's a wonderful scene. You are listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with T.C. Boyle, author of The Inner Circle. You have such a facility for metaphor and simile. One can learn quite a bit about just fictional technique by reading your books. For instance, on page 75, you say, "The day was dismal, hanging like lint in the windows," which, of course, is a completely original simile. Did this just come to you, or were you sitting, staring out the window, going, "What would this dismal tank day be like?"
Yes, it just comes.
It just comes to you.
As we were talking earlier, I don't think you can force similes, or because you'll be overwriting, nor can you force symbols or themes onto the work. It just has to happen and come naturally with what you're doing. And some writers, wonderful writers like the late Stanley Elkin, for instance, overdid similes to the point at which every sentence has 10 similes in it. And everyone would say, "Stanley, please." But he was so great at it, and it was such a gift of his that it became a foundation of his aesthetic, and that was how you knew his style.
Yeah.
But still, enough is enough, maybe, you know? and I think you have to know when and try to let the narrative flow smoothly. But yes, the language is very important to me. The rhythm of the language, the way it sounds aloud, is very, very important. And so, too, the beauty of it, the beauty of images. The whole idea of this is to make you, the reader, see it and recreate it in your own way. And I think that's part of why we like all the arts. It enables us to participate and to do that.
True. Read to us again your part two reading.
Oh, would you like to read again already?
Yeah, that'd be great.
Okay, good. Let me introduce this second little section. John Milk has become Kinsey's first assistant, and they travel widely in order to collect sex histories. As we said, typically Kinsey would give a lecture, often well attended because of its subject matter, the frankness that he was going to discuss sex, in which he was going to discuss sex, and he would then ask people to give up their histories, and he and his staff would collect them. At this point, there are only two, Kinsey and the very young John Milk. To this point, Kinsey has only trusted Milk with male histories, and usually of young men, college men around his age, which really aren't that extensive. And for reasons of embarrassment, perhaps, he hasn't allowed him to yet interview women. But on this particular day, after a lecture at a university, they've booked all of these people, Kinsey realizes that they booked two women for the same hour, and rather than give that up, he quizzes John all night long, He's a terrible taskmaster, making sure that John can properly interview this woman. Here is the result. There was a knock at the door. I was seated in an armchair by a dormant fireplace, the schedule sheet, and Mrs. Fauchet's folder spread out on a coffee table before me. The other chair, mahogany, red plush, standard Edwardian hotel fare, was positioned directly across from mine. "Come in," I said, rising to greet her even as the door swung open. In the doorway, peering into the room as if she'd somehow fetched up in the wrong place, was a very pretty young woman dressed in the height of fashion, dressed as if she'd just stepped out of a nightclub on 42nd Street after an evening of dinner, dancing, and champagne. She gave me a hesitant smile. "Oh, hello," she said. I wasn't sure if I was in the right place. I'd crossed the room to her, and now I took her hand and gave it a curt, professional shake. "It's really, well, really kind of you to come, and important, too, because every history, no matter how extensive or unextensive, non-extensive, I mean, contributes to the whole in a way that... Her smile opened up suddenly, a dazzling, full-lipped smile that made whole flocks of birds take off and careen round my stomach. "Oh, it's my pleasure," she murmured, as I motioned to the chair and watched her settle into it. "Anything for science, eh?" I offered her a cigarette. She chose a lucky, lit it for her, and wished it were 9 in the evening rather than 9 in the morning so we could both have a drink. A drink would have gone a long way toward calming my case of nerves. "Good," I said, poised over the interview sheet, pencil in hand. "So, Mrs. Fauchet, perhaps you'd like to tell me something of yourself." "Alice. Call me Alice." "Yes, Alice. You've lived here long? Here in West Lafayette, I mean?" The small talk, designed, as I've said, to put the subject at ease, consumed perhaps 5 minutes, and then my brain froze up. I couldn't help noticing how Mrs. Fauchet's breasts filled out the material of her blouse, filled it to the point of strain, and how silken her legs looked in a pair of sheer stockings. A moment of silence passed like a freight train. "All right, then," I said. "So, you lived in Trenton, you say, until what age?" I did manage to get into the rhythm of things as we moved along through the factual data. Number of brothers, sisters, twin status, sorority membership, frequency of attending motion pictures, etc. Keeping it in a simple question-response mode, and even the early sequential questions about onset of puberty came off well. But I'm afraid I broke down a bit when we got to the more sensitive areas. When did you first begin to masturbate?" I asked, lighting a cigarette myself. "Oh, I must have been 11, she said, drawing at her lucky. Or maybe it was 12. She threw her head back and exhaled, no more concerned than if she were at the hairdresser's or conferring with a girlfriend on the telephone. We were living in Newark still, and I remember the curtains. My mother had made them for me when I was a child, very colorful, decorated with little figures out of nursery rhymes, Mother Goose, that sort of thing. My sister Jean, she's a year older than I, she showed me the technique." I set down the cigarette, made a notation in the proper square. "Yes. And what was that technique?" She tried to look away, but I held her with my eyes. I didn't blink, didn't move. "Well, you might find this odd or maybe hard to believe." "No," I said, and my voice was so pinched I could barely get it out. "No, not at all. There is no activity we haven't recorded, and certainly as Proc, Dr. Kinsey, that is, outlined in the lecture last night, we make no judgments." She seemed encouraged. She patted her hair, which was piled up and pinned at the crown in a roll, with the bangs brushed into an exaggerated pompadour, reminiscent of the way Dolly Dawn used to wear her hair, and most people, I think, will remember her from George Hall's band. "It's a Sin to Tell a Lie" should ring a bell, at the very least, Yellow Basket. "Well," she said, "I'm double-jointed. So's Jean and my brother Charlie." "Yes," I said, pencil poised. Jean and I, would get up on the bed side by side and do a kind of backflip, you know, the sort of thing acrobats do at the circus, only we would hold it there and then, well, because of being double-jointed, we would lick ourselves." The term that came into my head was auto-cunnilingus. Proc hadn't yet devised a box or code for that one, so I made a spontaneous notation. I was probably blushing. Certainly I was hard. We forged on. "Was this her first marriage?" "Yes." "Had she experienced deep kissing prior to the time she was married?" "Yes." "Had she experienced petting?" "Yes." "Had she fondled the male genitalia, experienced mouth-to-genital contact, engaged in coitus?" "Yes, yes, and yes." "How many partners had she had, excluding her husband?" "Oh, somewhere, she guessed, around 20. 20, I repeated, trying to keep my voice neutral. She couldn't say, really. It might have been a few less or even as many as 25, and her eyes went dreamy a moment as she tried to recollect. And what about orgasm? When was the first time she was aware of having experienced an orgasm? Had she been able to bring herself to orgasm through masturbation, petting, intercourse? When had she most recently experienced an orgasm? And here was where I found myself in deep water again, because I asked this conventionally pretty and very likely pampered professor's wife, this elegant, blonde jewel of a woman dressed in impeccable taste, the next question in the sequence, that is, how many orgasms do you experience, on average? She was on her fifth cigarette, and if she'd been relaxed from the outset, now she was as warm and enthusiastic as any individual I'd interviewed. She looked at me, gave a little smile. I had been continuously and unprofessionally hard for the better part of 2 hours now. Oh, I would guess maybe 10 or 12. My face must have shown my surprise, because few even of our highest rating individuals would have approached that numerical category. Per week, I asked, and then, stupidly, or is that a monthly approximation? Now it was her turn to blush, just the faintest reddening of the flesh under both cheekbones and around the flanges of her nostrils. Oh, no, she said. No, I'm afraid that would be daily.
Thank you very much. That was T.C. Boyle reading from Inner Circle. And, you know, I am curious. This book has been reviewed by so many different journals and magazines, so well reviewed. Are you immune to that at this point, after having so many books so well reviewed? Does that affect you? Do you care?
I do care, and I love to be loved just like everyone else. I think what I'm doing is worthwhile, and I'm happy to be given credit for it. That said, you have to understand that each individual will have a different take on you and your work, and some may be prejudicial and some may not. Some may be for you or against you before they even read it. So I don't think a performer or an artist can really take that sort of thing very seriously. On the other hand, of course, really negative or unfair reviews can really hurt you very deeply. The way that I insulate myself from all of that is I'm traveling in the middle of a tour by the time the reviews come out. And yes, this book has been probably more widely reviewed than any of my books. Everybody has run an opinion on it here and there. I usually get these reviews in a big packet while I'm traveling someplace. And truthfully, I really don't have the time or interest to delve very deeply. My editor will give me some good quotes once in a while to keep me perked up and feeling okay on the road. But really, I don't any longer read them, good or bad. I think, really, they're not for me. They're for the public, to help the public form an opinion on what the book is about and whether or not they want to read it.
Hmm. So along those same lines, then, by the time a book comes out and you are touring, you're on a plane somewhere, hoping that the trip would be shorter, are the books you're promoting over for you because you are on to a new one?
Oh, of course. I mean, that's the conundrum of this whole business. The audience members asking me questions each night, the journalists talking with me, know the book, in most cases, much more intimately than I do. They've just read it. And for me, it's ancient history. I've, already well into the next one. In the case of this particular book, here I am talking to you, but the next book is ready to come out next fall, and the one I'm working on now is progressing well, and I hope to have it for the following year. So I'm in another world altogether.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting.
But I do vaguely recall having written this book, The Inner Circle, and I thought it was pretty good.
So. Well, your picture's on the jacket, so it looks like
that's
you.
That's a giveaway, huh? Oh, yeah, so it is.
Oh, yeah. Well, speaking of which, I mean, you are so prolific. You write, you teach, you have a family. How is it that you're so prolific? Is it that discipline of sitting there every day from whatever time to 2 or 3 o'clock writing? Or what is it?
It's just simply physiological. I was born naturally caffeinated, so I have more energy than any 8 people. That's why I'm skin and bones and have been all my life. There's that. There's the sort of obsessive-compulsive nature of being a writer. And yes, there is that discipline of seeing a work through. And not only that, but at the outset I made that joke about the sorrow and suffering of creating art. And that's part of it, but also there's a great joy to it. And when you get into that rhythm of creating something and feel that joy, it's hard to give up. It's something you want again and again. Listeners will know on my website, tcboyle.com, I have, in About the Author, there's a little essay called This Monkey, My Back, in which I talk about my origins as a writer and compare the thrill of creating something to a kind of addiction, to a kind of rush that that you might feel when using certain drugs.
Yeah, interesting.
So you want that feeling. You want to get to your computer and work because it's a joy to do it.
You've taught since 77. Why? I would imagine at this point, long ago, if you did not want to teach any longer for any sort of income, it would be gone.
Yeah, no, that's true. I've been very fortunate with my readership that I haven't, for a long while, don't have to go and do any job. I don't want to. You're slightly inaccurate. I started in 78 at USC.
Okay, well, your bio here that your publisher said.
Well, it's just slightly inaccurate that by 1 year.
Okay.
It's my 27th year. I'm proud of it. Pleased to be there. It's the only university where I've ever taught.
Yeah.
I love it. I love my students. I want to give them what I was given. I had great mentors who found something in me that I didn't know about in myself. I can name them off, and I'm still in contact with those who are still with us, and they meant the world to me. And I want to give that same thing to my students. I believe so much in the power of this talent of literature, and I want to help make sure that it continues into the future and help be the mentor for the young writers, just as I had mentors, too.
Susan Strait, I think, took a class with you long ago.
No, Susan was never in my class. She was a student in our program at the time, early on when I first began teaching. She said to me that she wanted to take my class, but that my appearance was too intimidating. And now, of course, we can laugh about it. I know her well, and she's a wonderful writer. And I wish she had been in the class, but it wasn't to be in that time.
Well, I recall her saying something about you then in terms of a certain encouragement you gave her.
Well, I did. We met privately, yes.
Really meaningful.
Yes, yes, yes. She came to my office. I met her and did encourage her because she's very gifted. Yes, 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 of course. And it's a pleasure to be able to do that and to see students of mine out succeeding in the world like Eric Garcia, the wonderful writer, novelist and film writer, whose most recent novel was made into the film Matchstick Men, Sandra Singh Lo, the wonderful performance artist, writer, and radio commentator. I mean, you know, these people are wonderful, absolutely.
Now, we're at the end of our time. Will you give our listeners who are writers some pearls of T.C. Boyle wisdom?
Pearls. Okay, well, here's one of my favorite quotes about the writer's life, which I found in the L.A. Times 20 years ago. One of our local writers was being asked by, it was Christopher Isherwood, was being asked by a reporter, so, you know, what's the most satisfying thing about the writer's life? And he said, without hesitation, getting checks in the mail. What a wise man. And it does feel good getting checks in the mail. It is good to be paid for what you do. It's good to be appreciated for what you do. And I do feel that with all the writers and all the books being published and the dwindling audience and all of that, nonetheless, I do feel that great talent will be recognized.
Thank you. Thank you so much for taking the time.
You're welcome, Barbara. I love your show, and I'm sure we'll talk again in the future.
Thanks a lot.
Okay.
That is T.C. Boyle, author of The Inner Circle, published by Viking. And when you see an event of his listed in one of our book reviews or somewhere online, he's a wonderful reader and performing artist, performing writer as well. So get out of your office and check him out in the flesh. It would be a treat for you to do that. Let me also say that the opinions and views that you've heard on this show are those of me and my guest and not those of the University of California Irvine Regents. And if you'd like to know more about Writers on Writing, you can visit my website, which is penonfire.com. There you can email me if you'd like to be on my weekly email list. And next week we will be here with New York City psychiatrist George Cohen, and we'll be talking about the writer's brain. I'm going to leave you with a quote by Katharine Graham, who said, "To love what you do and feel that it matters, how could anything be more fun?" Thank you for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Until next week.
Here to cry. You know I love her. She's my desire. Oh, she's my desire. Oh, she's my desire. Oh, she's my desire. Now she's my desire.